Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Ted Santos, and I am your host of The Creative Alchemist, and we come to you live every Thursday from 7 until 8, and we talk to you about business, all the things that you want to think about and do about and have considered about business. And the way our show is structured, we have guests every week, and those guests have expertise in specific areas, from legal to finance to wealth management, leadership, even health. And today, well, we've got what I would call a high performer. You're going to be impressed with her story. And before I introduce our guest, you have to know I never take this journey alone. I always have a co-pilot. Lori, let them know you're here.
Hi, it's Lori Miller from LGC Interior Design, and it's nice to see you back again on a Thursday night. There is pretty much two more weeks left to the Man Woman of the Year fundraiser, so make a difference. Donate to Leukemia. We're having a comedy show coming up on June 2nd. So we'd love to see you. It's Zoom, so it's safe, even though I think the world is opening up. And you can find the link at LGC Interiors or Facebook. And also, if you Google lls.org, Man Woman of the Year, you'll find me, Lori Miller, as a candidate, and you can find a link to donate. Still looking for a sponsor. If anybody wants to sponsor me, that would be great. So, and tonight's guest, I want to thank, I'm going to let her introduce herself. She is amazing. So, Leah, please introduce yourself and tell us how you went from the criminal court system into purchasing and selling buildings.
you make her sound like she was arrested for something, the criminal court system selling. So, this... We don't want our audience to think that we had someone who beat the criminal system and then went into real estate. So,
no, Ali is very brilliant, actually. So, yeah, Leah, introduce yourself.
Thank you both. thank you so much for the introduction. Very excited to be speaking with you both. I never went to law school. I didn't end up going to law school. It was always a dream of mine to be a lawyer, and I considered like strongly going into criminal justice, but I didn't end up making it to law school. I got an internship when I was really young in the real estate field, and it kind of opened my eyes to things. It kind of like shattered my world because I always envisioned myself as an attorney. And when people meet me today, it's funny. They still tell me that I kind of like have that, I guess, like aura around me. But I got an internship. Yeah, I got an internship in the real estate field, and it really intrigued me. And I figured I have to explore it more, you know, being that the barriers to entry are so low. It's very cost effective, which is why there's so many people in the field. But it was interesting. So I got into it, I got my license, and have been doing it ever since.
That is so awesome. Now, you said you do a lot of development, and you reach out to investors, developers. Tell us a little bit, I guess, how you find them, how you do your research, how you get your foot in the door.
Definitely. So I do a lot of like neighborhood scouting, like focusing on the areas that we already work in, which are pretty broad. We're pretty active throughout the five boroughs, mostly in Manhattan, Brooklyn. I grew up in Queens, so I know the Queens market pretty well. But it's pretty much just, you know, having our feet on the ground, walking the neighborhood, seeing what projects are being built, and then taking it from there, reaching out to the owners on those properties and introducing ourselves. And then we also try and, like, nurture a lot of our own personal connections, because those are truly the best connections, reaching out to the people we know and letting them know that We work in the field and we work on ground up projects, conversions, gut rehab, and yeah, just kind of spreading the word. That's really the best way.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you are, you're not a commercial real estate agent, are you? Is that, would you consider yourself that?
Right. So I'm a residential real estate agent. So I have done some commercial, but our bread and butter is residential.
Okay. So how does that work? You work with developers. Maybe most people won't understand typically how that works. And I just for those who like to call in and ask Leah a question, the phone number is 516-387-1640. That's 516-387-1640. And you can call in live. So how does that work, Leah? I mean, you're residential and you speak directly to people who are on the commercial end. Is that a correct way to say it?
I guess you could put it that way. I mean, we work with developers on their projects really from start to finish. So we prefer to get in there from the very beginning when they're just even acquiring the site, just so we can speak to them about like potential routes they can take, whether the rental route is the best, if they should build like residential rentals, if they should go high end, if they should stay more, you know, applicable to the general crowd. But we like to get in early if possible, also so we can advise them on like layouts, you know, what makes the most sense in terms of the bedroom dimensions or having an office space or having a dining nook or private outdoor space. So we work with developers very directly to guide them on what makes the most sense in terms of profitability, in terms of turnover, how like quickly and how efficiently a property is going to sell, to guide them even on finishes, like design finishes. We do everything from the sales to the marketing. So we also help with the branding of the property and creating a story behind every building that's going to, you know, attract to someone's lifestyle. Because when you're selling property, you're not just selling property. You're really selling a lifestyle.
Right.
So we take care of that whole marketing, the branding, the logo, the website creation, everything from A to Z.
That's interesting. I didn't know real estate agents and brokers worked so closely with real estate developers. So, you know, I assume they do some level of or market research to understand the community, the people in it, what they're looking
right.
for, except you all are, you know, boots on the ground. You know exactly what people are looking for and what they walk away from.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's crucial, especially when a developer is launching a building. You have to understand the buyer profile. You have to dig into the neighborhood. You have to understand, you know, what's the average family size? What's their household income? Do they have cars? Do they work from home? You know, what do they enjoy in the neighborhood? What's their favorite spot? So all of these factors, they're going to affect the type of product you're going to build, the pricing, and who you're going to be targeting, like how you're going to market the property to attract the right person. So it's very, very thorough. We look at a lot of different details because that's really what makes a project successful in the end of the day.
So actually, and that's good for, so someone wants to buy a home, you would know exactly where, especially if they're looking for a new home, you would know exactly your client profile and the kind of developers that would interest them most.
Mm-hmm.
So someone looking for a home would want to speak to you because if they could lay out, I mean, you sound like a consultant, right? So you go to the real estate
pretty much
developers. And you're providing a very valuable service, and the end buyer, the end consumer who buys the home would really want to engage you because you know who's building what and who's going to meet their needs.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's so interesting that you said consultant, because many, many real estate agents, I would say if not all, really consider themselves to be more of advisors instead of agents. Like, I actually have a problem with the word salesperson. I never liked the word, because I think that it gives off a certain connotation as if we're salespeople. Like, we're just selling new products. We're not actually connecting with you and understanding what your needs are, what your lifestyle is, what you're looking for, and what type of product is going to be a solution to your current problems or your current needs. So that's something that a lot of, you know, that's, I guess, why I don't like the word, but that's also why a lot of us as agents, we really do see ourselves more as advisors, if not therapists, because we're really getting down to the nitty-gritty. Like, buying a property is very emotional for a lot of people. You know, it's all of their life savings.
Right.
It's not a regular purchase. There's a lot that goes into it. So there's a lot of hand-holding, especially with first-time buyers.
And when you go to closing, they have all these documents, like you're signing your firstborn away. You know, I was the worst customer closing because I wanted to read everything. So they're like, oh, no, this just says XYZ. I'm like, yeah, I'm signing this, not you.
Funny. I mean, we have like a range of buyers. We have the buyers where they do read every single document, and then we have those that really trust the attorney. So when the attorneys say, like, okay, like, just gives like a, like, paraphrases what the paper is, they just wholeheartedly trust them. I probably will be the same way. I think I would have read every single word.
I'm the one that would not read anything, and I would trust everybody. For sure.
They may have several closings that day, so the last thing is they need people like us, right, to delay it like another 30 minutes or so. So
yeah,
they're late for the next one. So you're sorry. Go ahead.
No. No. You go first.
Well, I was going to say you solve problems, but I'd like to, before we get more into what you do, I want to talk about the problem of the real estate industry. Is there one now? Is what's happening with the real estate market? And I'm sure you can give us New York City, but maybe you can give us also a snapshot for the nation. So you tell me.
Yeah, I mean, nationwide, it's not just in New York, but nationwide, the problem that we're seeing is that there isn't enough inventory on the market. There is a lot of buyers looking. It's almost comical, because this time last year, no one would have thought that we would have, that we are. But we are in a situation where we have a handful of buyers looking that are very, very eager to be looking, but there isn't enough options to choose from. And because of this, especially in Brooklyn, which is one of the markets that we focus on very strongly, we're seeing like multiple bids going on. Like within a week, there are multiple bids coming onto a property that's just been listed for like 7-8 days. So it's pretty awesome, but at the same time, it's also very frustrating. And some buyers are getting discouraged, and they feel that it's not the time to look right now, because there isn't enough to choose from. We're hoping that as the summer, you know, as we progress with summer months, we'll see more inventory coming on the market.
So what does that mean, that the developers are not building as much, or did they, did COVID, so what, why is this happening for one? Did COVID, like, is COVID the catalyst for this problem?
It's a good question. I don't think it's definitely not because of developers. In fact, the opposite. What I should have clarified is that we're seeing there's a lot of inventory amongst new developments, like the supply is saturated, which is why in the next 2 to 3 years, we're probably not going to be seeing a lot of new projects being built. I think we need to consume all of this inventory amongst new developments. which is good because probably construction costs are going to come down a little bit. But on the flip side, in the resale market, not on new buildings, but on just properties that are being resold, that's where we are seeing this dilemma, that owners are, you know, either it's because maybe they refinanced their home during COVID and the rates they got, you know, tremendously good rates, and they're not as excited or eager to sell or list their home. I think also a lot of people that are living in townhouses right now and are very comfortable and have a beautiful backyard and a spacious home, a lot of them understand the value of their property. And, you know, considering 2020 and what we went through, they know how desirable it is to have a property that is super spacious and has the backyard where their, you know, dogs can run around and they can go and tan in the back. So I think that's what we're seeing. I think we're seeing sellers that are a little bit more on the fence and are reconsidering whether they want to sell, for both of those reasons.
Okay. So, but do you think it was, because of COVID, there's just a glut of real estate or glut of buyers, like there are too many buyers?
Mm-hmm.
Who want, like, pent-up demand, I guess is the right word.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely pent-up demand, which is what a lot of us were projecting to happen. You know, people were stuck in their homes for months. Either they've gotten so comfortable with their homes that they know either they want to downsize or they want to upsize. So there's a lot of pent-up demand. But there's also sellers that they know they have good value. And I always say, like, New York City, the thing about New York is that it really moves in waves. Like, if you look at just how the market has shifted, like, every 4 years, it goes exactly like in a wave. So we're going through one of those shifts. And I think we just have to keep in mind that eventually, you know, as we're approaching a seller's market because of the very limited inventory, eventually it'll flip and it'll fully transition into a buyer's market. But I think, you know, considering the situation we're in right now, it's a really, really good time for sellers. Like, sellers really have the upper hand. So it's important for owners to realize this, that they have a really good window right now to sell their homes at prices that could not have received in the past few years. So something that we're telling all of our clients and also just, you know, the people that we know in the neighborhoods we work in, just like letting them know that now is a really good time to consider, like, what your home could sell for.
So,
Ted got quiet.
No,
we're thinking, we're absorbing.
So I mean, what one of the things that's happening is, I've heard stories of people offering. So we're getting into bidding wars because of this. So, you know, five people bid on one property and they, let's say they ask, I'll just keep it simple. They ask 100,000 and someone offers 105, someone else offers 115 and the property appraises for 99. All right, isn't that a problem also?
Definitely. I mean, it definitely is a problem. I will say it's interesting to see that we're encountering less of those problems. I think with just how the market is shifting, appraisers are also aware of that. They're very cognizant of the fact that there's a lot of pent-up demand and interest on some of the properties. So it's very rare that we come across appraisal issues. And even if we do, we usually can request for a second appraisal to be done.
Okay.
But I will also add, like, some buyers that are very emotionally attached to properties and they're very eager to win a bid, some of them will drop the appraisal contingency. And they'll say that if, for some reason, or they'll drop the mortgage contingency, which kind of is an umbrella for the appraisal contingency. And they'll say that if a property appraises, I don't know, 10, 20K below, they would still be willing to move forward and cover the difference. So we are seeing that, like the very excited and passionate buyers, they are reevaluating how they're proposing their offers.
Is that, so in your professional opinion, is that dangerous for the market?
It's a good question. I think it depends. It really depends on every property. If a property is priced really competitively to start, and it's even priced under the real market value in order to attract a lot of attention, I would say maybe, maybe not. Like we would want to evaluate what the comps have sold for and also evaluate what's currently listed. Because based on what's currently listed, we could tell that in the next 3-4 months, are they going to buy something that's overpriced or are they going to buy something in line with the market? If we're in a market where there's just a ton of pent-up demand and almost every single property is getting eaten up within just a week or two on the market, it's pretty unlikely that when they come to sell their property, they're going to have issues. Because the other properties that sold during that same time frame are likely going to sell at a very similar margin, at a very similar price range.
Right. But this can't go on forever, though.
It can't go on forever, but that's also what affects the market, right? Like buyers, what buyers are willing to pay for a property is really what affects and changes a market and what changes the market for a whole neighborhood. So if the property values rise, because, right, New York moves in waves, if the property values rise, then when they come to sell in the future, it's kind of going to be like a stepping stone, like the next 4 or 5 years when they plan to sell and the market appreciates and when it shifts, it'll appreciate from that point up.
Okay. No, I
do see your concern, though. I do understand how you're thinking about it.
It's almost like it's creating a bubble of, you know, artificially inflated. Where people are artificially inflating real estate,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of pent-up demand.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so interesting you put it that way because New York really is a bubble. Like the market of New York is a bubble in and of itself compared to other markets.
Right.
The market is literally like a living, breathing organism. It moves differently. Like it's totally different. The pace of how we move, of how buyers search, just the timeline of when a buyer starts their search to when they start making offers, it's generally a much quicker search, you know, relative to other neighborhoods, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey,
right.
Because things move quickly, especially like we're speaking about sales. But even if we look at it like on a micro level, if we look at the rental market moves extremely quickly. You know, when I speak to like out-of-state clients, I have to like consistently remind them that we need to have everything lined up. We need to have all our documents lined up because things move so, so quickly.
Okay.
So it is definitely a bubble.
So I guess I kind of have, well, let me ask my question first and then we'll go into the next piece. So like you were just saying, you know, it may appraise for less than the value of it or, you know, what the seller would be asking or what is wanted and then mm-hmm. appraise for less. So a couple of weeks ago, or maybe even two, we had a mortgage broker on who does renovation loans. So now someone like her, she would appraise the property for more and provide that difference in a mortgage, right, in the funding of the mortgage so that they could clear up the property, invest in it, and then bring it to its full value. So is that mm-hmm. something that's sort of taken into consideration at that point, or is that something completely different?
So I'm curious, do you remember which market she was in, like which state or city she was actively working in?
Yeah, she was out in Long Island.
Okay. So it could be, I know there are lenders that they are specifically hired by the bank, like when an investor or a purchaser gets a construction loan in order to do
uh-huh.
renovation on a property, like if they don't have
uh-huh.
money to do the renovation, they'll get something called a construction loan. And in that
mm-hmm.
case, the bank, does have to send out like an independent appraiser to go in there and tell you what the after repair value would be, because that's how they determine if they want to give you a loan, how much the loan would be. So that could be, I'm thinking that could be what she was referencing. In New York, like, let's say, I don't know, in Brooklyn, for example, when you're buying a condo or a co-op or a townhouse, generally, if you're not getting a construction loan and you're just buying it outright, they appraise it at its current, like, its current condition, its current state.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Have you thought of investing, Lori?
I would love to invest. You and I will have lunch over that one.
But
yeah, I would love to invest. That's one of my dreams, you
yeah,
know, because
no,
every property I've ever owned has been an investment. You know, I've always bought it as a short sale or, you know, a foreclosure, fixed it up and then sold it. So,
oh, wow.
Natural.
So you've done it already.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's
yeah,
so sweet. How many properties have you worked on? Wait, what did you say?
Unfortunately, I've lived in them. I would say three.
That's so awesome. Which areas were you in?
All of Long Island. So, you know, mostly two in the South Shore and now on the North Shore.
That's so awesome. How was the experience, like, renovating or finding those properties?
So as a designer, it's kind of, you know, I couldn't move into something that's already done because I have my own ideas in my head, and I walk in and I see a space very differently. So it didn't make sense for me to ever buy anything that was already completed. So for me, it was an easy, you know, it was an easy decision and something that I truly looked for. If that makes
sense. So it's so interesting because, no, for sure. Like a lot of the people that I know that have creative eyes and they're artists or they're designers, they've told me the same thing, that every time they walk into a property, or even the first home they bought, even if they're not investors, they're just, you know, regular owners, they've, almost all of them have bought properties that needed work. Like it was very hard for them to walk in. And I see this even like with the clients that I work with that are very, very artistic and creative. They're usually more attracted to the properties that they can go in there and put a personal touch on.
Right. Yeah, and that just makes perfect sense.
We just proved I'm not an artist. I like to walk in and it's already everything's done.
So, Leah, do you do your own properties? Or let me ask you a better question. Do you hire a realtor when you're looking for your own properties?
I do. And I do it because, like, realtors really, the good realtors, the ones that actually know what they're talking about, they know the areas very, very well. Like, they can easily advise you and suggest, like, which property is overpriced or, you know, what's the best coffee shop in the area or the schools that you should keep in mind. So it's important. Like, I think realtors really are like consultants, and they are almost like also project managers. Like, they do a lot more than just the search and, you know, the basic stuff. So I think it's important. It's good to have a realtor who's like, who comes in handy and really, really can make things more efficient.
You know, a follow-up question to that. So you're in the business. So what do you look for? How do you know a realtor is good? And so I want to do both sides. And what are the things that would cause you? So I guess I have a few questions, right? So I want to know what you would think of, it takes for a realtor to be good, but are there certain conditions where you might, it may be appropriate to fire your realtor?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple things. I mean, I think the very basic to start, like, you want to make sure that your realtor has common sense. Because getting into the field is very, very easy. Like I said earlier, the barriers to entry are so low. You know, I think it's like 72 hours and then two exams that you take. There's the industry is like oversaturated. There's a bunch of real estate agents, especially in New York. So I would say, like, one, you want to look for someone who obviously, like, you relate to, not just emotionally or personality-wise, but also, you know, on an intellectual level, someone that can answer your questions and you see they understand the market and they're not just talking gibberish or avoiding your questions or just saying yes, yes, yes to everything, but actually being upfront. If they don't know something, they're actually going to go and find out and not just, like, you know, yes you. But also, you know, on top of that, I think you want to look for someone who is really just determined, who's super committed, who's accessible, who's going to be available when you reach out and not push you off for hours, but someone who you can tell is prioritizing your needs and your investment and your search, and also someone that has good energy. Like, you want to speak to someone that, you know, to go back to what, to the first point, someone that you relate to but is also upbeat and enthusiastic and excited to, you know, to take you on your search and not kind of, yeah, I think just emotionally just connects with you also on an emotional level.
So not someone who says, hey, look, I'm really busy, I can't get to all your stuff. Like, that's probably not.
Yeah, and or just says it through their actions, right? Just through the way, just how quickly they are responding to you and how eager they are to help. I think response rate is a really big thing in the industry.
So that I assume response rate is one of the things that separates the average performers from the high performers.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I've had a couple of clients tell me in the past that the reason why they were so attracted to working with me was because of my response rate, because I was so quick to respond. I tend to work a lot. It's not healthy. I don't recommend it. But I do work a lot, and slowly I'm like shaving down on that. But yeah, it's just being accessible. I'm not saying you have to answer your emails at 11, 12 o'clock like I do, but just being accessible to your client and showing them that you care about their search and you care about their needs.
Okay. All right. Okay. Lori, I think you had more questions.
Yeah, it was more of, I guess, just an observation, but honestly, we got into the construction loan and I forgot. So but I'm sure I'll come back to it at some point. But now, I guess, in terms of accessibility, right, because how do you, you know, as a business owner, how do you set those boundaries? You know, like, people think that texting at 1 o'clock in the morning is okay, and then if they don't get an answer by 8 o'clock in the morning, it's like, you know, it's the seventh worst sin in the world, or it's the seven deadly sins. So how do you set that boundary? What do you do?
Yeah.
For you personally?
I think for me personally, I mean, I think almost every independent contractor or business owner, like, they really have to set that boundary for themselves. Like, they have to ask themselves, what are they not just most comfortable with, but capable of? When I first started out in real estate, it was very, very hard for me. And it still is very hard for me, like, getting emails sometimes from clients at midnight or 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And if I happen to be awake, I'll respond. Usually I'll respond. But you also want to set that boundary. Like, you want to know when at a certain point you can't get to every message right away, and that's okay. I think generally my rule of thumb is that I try to get back to every client, like, within an hour. Once it's, like, really late, if we're already, like, past 9 or 10, really past, like, 10, maybe 11, then I probably won't respond right away, and I'll wait till the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, ultimately you just have to ask yourself, like, what – you have to define, you know, like, your boundaries for yourself. And you have to ask yourself, like, what is most comfortable for you and what's healthy on your level? Because some people, they're okay. You know, it's totally fine and it's totally normal for them to be, you know, answering emails at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. A lot of agents the super successful ones are already up super early. So yeah, I think it's a boundary that everyone has to define for themselves.
Yeah.
What about you guys? I mean, how do you guys go about defining those boundaries?
Ted, I'll let you answer that first.
When we finished with the podcast today, I already have a call with a client. So,
me too, Ted, by the way.
And it won't be a 5-minute conversation. But it's an important one. So it's about important decisions. So, you know, some of your clients have more, have important decisions to make. It affects their business, or in your case, it could affect their life for the next, you know, forever in some cases, or, you know, for the next several years. So, so I find ways to accommodate clients. I honor the sense of urgency that they have in running their business. So, but I'm not.
Right. Is there
at 1 a.m.
Is there certain hours that? Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I don't think they would do that. But you know. So yeah, I don't know what the cutoff. I mean, these are usually pretty smart people, and they often have families, so they, you know, there's a cutoff. But
right.
We it's sort of like an unspoken beyond a certain time. Maybe 9 o'clock is the latest I've been on the phone with someone. It ended the call at 9 o'clock.
Right. Because then at a certain point, you also have to ask yourself, like, to what degree, like, how well are you servicing their needs? Like, if you're exhausted and just tired and it's late, you may not be giving the best consulting advice. Or just the best services. So I usually play it by ear. Like if I'm up late and I'm running and I'm okay, like I will answer a couple emails. But I try and put like my health first and my peace of mind first.
Right. And I'll be speaking to a client also thinking that I've got to get out and go to the gym also. So, yes.
Yeah. Do you have set hours for when you hit the gym, or it's more spontaneous for you?
No, more like ideally, if I can get out at 8:30, that's perfect. My gym closes at 11, so I put in some a decent amount of time. It could be 90 minutes plus. So I'm truly committed to my health.
So you go at night?
Correct. Yes.
Such a night owl. Like I actually enjoy going to the gym in the evening compared to the morning.
Well, they also research says that you get better development from working out in the evening than you do in the morning, at least with weights.
Oh, I have no idea. That's so good to know.
Yeah, so.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
So, cool. Lori, you let me go first. Did you want to answer? See, we're getting interviewed, Lori, on our show.
I know.
That's how I am, guys. I love to ask questions. Interviews are always difficult for me because I love to learn about people. Like, I love to know about them too. So when people ask me questions, I just reciprocate it. I'm like, oh, what about you?
Right. Well, so interviews make for an interesting guest.
Mm-hmm.
And fun. So let's see. Boundaries. So I do. I will not answer my phone before 8 o'clock in the morning. Unless it's like one of my contractors and I know that we're going to be on the job at 8 because we do start early. And I shut down at 9 o'clock at night. So it's about a 12-hour day, a little bit more. But after 9 o'clock, I won't answer. You know, I'm just like, no. And I'll take my phone. I won't put it near my bed. The sound is off. And, you know, it just has to wait. you know, I really need that downtime.
Right. Yeah. And that's even with clients that are out of state.
That's even with clients out of state.
Yeah. That's really great.
Yeah.
It's important. It's important to really define your own boundaries.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. I mean, I used to get crazy phone calls at 11 o'clock at night, and it was like, oh, I'm looking in bed, and I don't like the paint color on my wall, and I'm like,
oh my gosh.
I can't fix it
That's
now.
You
know, I would love to, but, you know, everything's closed, so, yeah. You know, so if you want, you can email me, and I'll respond in the morning. You know, and I never let anything go unresponded unless I didn't get it. But but I think, you know, when I do, you know, think it's important to respond to people, I just think it's important to set those limits.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Leah, I want to ask about buying real estate, specifically in Manhattan. It could be any of the boroughs. So young people buying a first home, really is Manhattan really a place for young people buying a first home, like in their 20s, let's say, mid-20s, no children? Is real estate affordable in any way in any part of the island of Manhattan for people, let's say, just above average income? And I guess in New York, above average is probably $125,000, something like that. That's just barely average, right?
Right. It's not the average nationwide. But like you hit it on the nail, you hit it on the head. In Manhattan, you know, the average income is much higher. The average income for even like a student just getting their first job and coming out of like grad school, so, you know, it correlates. The prices directly correlate to that income level. And in Manhattan, the bulk of Manhattan's housing market are co-ops. So there's co-ops, condos, and then there's also townhouses or single multifamilies, which are already on the high-end side of pricing. But let's just say we're looking at a co-op because the co-op really consumes the majority of the housing market in Manhattan. Co-ops are, you know, they're multi-level. There's a few things that you have to look at when you're evaluating a co-op. It's not just down payment. They also want to see something called post-closing liquidity. They want to see how much money you're going to have in the bank after you make your down payment. They also want to see something called debt-to-income ratio, which is what is your total monthly expenses with your mortgage compared to your total gross income on a monthly basis. So the co-ops generally don't want to see more than like 30%. The rule of thumb is really more than 30% DTI. So it's not always the easiest for young professionals who are in their early 20s to be purchasing properties on their own because of these different layers that are required, which, you know, at times it could be overwhelming to some people, but I think it's very important because that's what keeps up the pricing and that's what keeps Manhattan's market very strong, the fact that there are all these requirements and the building and the owners are very protected in that sense. So I would say for first-time buyers in their 20s, I think Manhattan could be a little bit difficult if you're not earning, you know, a very high income. But that's why there's also condos, and that's why, you know, a lot of these buildings allow co-purchasing, so you can purchase with someone else who may have better income or with a parent, or you can receive gifting from a family member. So, yeah, there's ways around it. So, yeah, I think because of the income in Manhattan and just the type of jobs that people get, I think it usually affords and allows them to purchase in the area.
And I was going to ask about gifting, so that's allowed. Okay, good.
Yeah. So you think Manhattan, so, you know, everyone was migrating from Manhattan out to either Long Island or up to Connecticut or down to Jersey for more room, get out of the apartment buildings, et cetera. So my assumption, and I could have been very wrong, was that housing prices were going down in Manhattan because there were so many vacant apartments. Am I wrong?
Not exactly. Not amongst sales. The rental market definitely saw a dip that it's still recovering from. I mean, the rental market it's been doing really well in the past few months just because now schools are reopening and students are coming back. A lot of students were like over Zoom and they were doing things, you know, through their computer. And because of that, they moved out and they went back to like their family home and their, you know, where they grew up. But now, considering that schools are opening up again, it is picking up. The sales market, I mean, there was like a three-month period where no one really knew what was going on, maybe 3, 4, or 5 months, and almost everything went on pause, and no one was really – I mean, we still had sales going on that were just over Zoom, like really just digital showings. But it definitely took a hit, like every industry took a hit during that interval, during that period. But I will say that because of that, a lot of these properties didn't sell at fire sales, like how people think that there was like a huge reduction, because sellers were uncertain, buyers were uncertain, no one really knew what was going to happen. So the whole market kind of went on pause. I don't think it didn't depreciate, it didn't decrease, it just went on pause. There were some new developments because inventory amongst new developments is really high and there's a lot of options. There are some projects that they did offer really, really good discounts. Very, very few. But across the board, we didn't see like a huge dramatic drop in pricing.
Okay. Yeah, I think everyone
thought
that.
It's actually interesting because... Yeah, no one would have thought. And we're doing better, like, in terms of pricing. We're actually doing better than pre-pandemic levels, like, than 2019. In terms of just, like, the sales. Yeah. Like, the sales levels in terms of how many contracts are being signed, the contract prices. We're doing much better. It's just inventory that's our problem right now.
So... let me just say, if anyone wants to call in, the phone number is 516-387-1640. And if you have, I'm going to put Lee on the spot. You can call in and ask her your toughest questions about buying a home, real estate, the complexities of our COVID real estate market that's affecting the entire nation. So... how do we look on that side, Lori? Any callers?
No callers yet, but Lee, maybe you want to tell people how to reach you as well in case they're shy and don't want to call in.
Yeah, definitely.
Or maybe they need a realtor, maybe they want to do a property investment.
For sure. Yeah, no, I'm happy to. You are more than welcome to reach me either directly through my cell, which is 347-985-4201. You could also just type my name in. It's Leia Azizian. I work with LG Fairmont, so you can look that up. My info is pretty much it's pretty accessible online. I'm also on social media, so like LinkedIn, Instagram. Pretty much you can just type my name in and you'll see it online.
So you get business sort of like the old-fashioned way, right? You canvas, you walk down the street, look for new development, and you start conversations with developers.
Yeah, exactly. We do a lot of canvassing, a lot of research on which projects, like what permits have been filed. It's a lot of tedious work, but it pays off. You just have to stay consistent and keep going at it.
Right. And as we were saying, you really serve in a consultative capacity with developers. I mean, your team has done rotten sales with developers, haven't, or just in general, like over $1 billion in sales?
Yeah, we've done over $1.5 billion in sales since 2010. And we've done over 3,200 rental transactions.
very good, and congratulations. Wow.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, we've done pretty well in the past 10 years.
So is that...
Yeah, that's really impressive.
Most real estate agents take that route, like in looking at developers, or do they just do it the traditional of just dealing with retail people coming in?
I think it depends. Like I help spearhead our development division in our brokerage. I think if you go to other brokerages in New York or nationwide, if you look into their development department, I'm sure there are people that are doing, you know, similar things. But the average real estate agent, they generally work more with, you know, just with people that are buying their first-time property or maybe investors or tenants. I don't think it's you don't find, like, the average agent working with developers. I think it's something that it really comes, especially with developers and with any client, you have to build trust with them, right? I know we spoke about that before, Ted, but it's all about trust. Like, every sale revolves around trust and building rapport with the client and building a relationship where, you know, it's where also they can relate to you and they can connect with you. So just, you know, that's just that applies to everyone, but especially when you're working with a developer who is selling, you know, a multi-million dollar project and are doing a huge rental complex, it comes with time. Like, building those relationships take a lot of time. It's very much so a long-term play. There aren't a lot of rent, you know, agents in the field that are willing to hold that out and really pursue those kind of relationships.
Okay.
I think it's awesome. I really think it's awesome. So we have 8 minutes left. So maybe if you just want to throw out your information again, and of course everybody can find you on my Facebook or Instagram pages at LGC Interiors, but how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you could just send me a text or an email or a call. My direct line is 347-985-4201. And my email, which could be hard to remember, but it's lazizian@lgfairmont.com. Azizian is azizian@lgfairmont.com.
So this, do you have any regrets of not becoming an attorney?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm definitely, sometimes I am curious about it, and I do wonder what life would be like as an attorney. And I mean, I think attorneys are awesome. I know a lot of them tend to have bad reps, and they come off some of the best schemers, which isn't the nicest thing to say, but I think there's a lot that goes into being an attorney. You know, you need a very particular, especially a successful attorney, you need like a very particular skill set. You have to know also like how to speak to people, how to connect to people, how to get them to trust you so they open up to you and they tell you what their situation is, especially when you're in the criminal justice field. So I think it's very, very similar to, you know, now that I do real estate, I think a lot of those skill sets are very, very similar. Just, you know, with how you deal with people and how you connect with them and being analytical and being a good negotiator. So I am curious about it. Sometimes I think about it, but I know it's always there. Like, you know, if I ever choose to pursue it, it's there.
Well, go ahead.
Okay, what were you saying?
I was just going to say that it's like all the kind of mindset of an attorney is still with you, and it's in your profession. Like, you still negotiate a lot. You still have to get to know people. Like, all the things you just named sounds like all the things, all the skills you use as a real estate consultant.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's also what attracted me to real estate so much, was that I realized that essentially the skill set that I have, like a skill set that I think many attorneys are born with, especially the successful ones. It just comes almost innately to them. But I think it's something that I just noticed. It's a very similar skill set, and I felt very comfortable with it. So, yeah.
And I would say real estate agents, more than attorneys, have to have kind of a bedside manners like doctors do. You have to walk your people through. I mean, you know, not everyone has bought many houses. You know, and especially if you're looking at this market where it's kind of abnormal with such a backlog of buyers, and it's just a frenzy. So it's, you know, sometimes people are dealing with things that they didn't anticipate, and it kind of changed the situation in negotiations, especially when, like we were talking about, the house, you're making an offer for higher than the appraisal. So that can create all kinds of concerns and anxiety for some people.
Definitely. It's interesting because I know, Lori, you have a similar situation. You went from criminal justice to what you do now, like totally different field, but a lot of your skill sets are the same, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they definitely transitioned over, and it helps in understanding my clients and what they want and, you know, how to read them and identify, you know, what's in their head or clarify what's in their head, you know, which is often, it's very hard to articulate a particular style or, you know, something that you want when you really don't, I guess you don't have the vocabulary to express it. So having that kind of mental health background is really helpful.
For sure. So, I remember when we spoke, you said something about home when we spoke. I forgot what the line was, but I loved it. Like, I remember that you said it, and I was just like, wow, that's an amazing line.
I know what you're talking about, and I don't remember.
What was it?
It's
Lori, you
something I say all the time, and it's like I don't know. Like, you just have to, you know, you have to love where you live. You have to feel like you're home. You know, it's all of those things.
Yeah.
I was looking to see if I wrote it down somewhere. I thought I... Okay.
Yeah, well, it was a really good line. It was almost like your motto.
Right. So
yep, exactly.
I'll remember when we're done here.
We'll all put it out on social media so you can refer back to it. Well, we're going to close up. Leah, thank you so much for being an amazing guest.
Thank you.
For sharing your wealth of knowledge. Everybody, I will not be on next week. It's going to be Ted flying solo. I'm going to be at our charity event for leukemia lymphoma in 10 days left. So please donate. And Ted, you want to sign out?
Well, actually, I do. We have less than 2 minutes. So, I haven't mentioned to anyone that I've published a book, and it was just launched last week. The name of the book is Here's Why You Can't Find Love. And I wrote the book to solve a $300 billion problem that corporate America is dealing with every year. And corporate America is losing $300 billion in workplace productivity because of divorce. So I wrote the book to help people better navigate relationships and more effective communication, conflict resolution, client relations, but to do it and to have skills that are transferable to their intimate life as well as in the workplace. So it's a great book. I didn't write it as Ted speaks. I wrote it. It's a five women interviewing me, so it's very dynamic. It's almost like reading a movie, and it's entertaining, educational, and a touch of autobiography. So you can find it on Amazon and any other online services. And that's my book. I'd love to have people buy it and give me some feedback. And with that, I'm going to say thank you very much, Leah. It's been great having you on the show. And everyone have
thank
a great
you. Such a pleasure. I really enjoyed speaking with you both. And
thank
Ted,
you, likewise.
Congratulations. So awesome.
Have a great evening.
Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.